Welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get in what I'm getting on. We're talking about what I'm reading about. We're going to break down some article. So without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good. It is good. It is good to be back. All right, here we go. Andrew Bilt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's do this thing, shall we? The first article I want to talk about comes in JAMA Internal Medicine. This is a meta-analysis of 78 original studies looking to find the accuracy of ECG interpretation. In this analysis, they looked at studies with med students, physicians, even attending cardiologists, and found on average, we got the diagnosis right only 55% of the time. Bum, bum, bum. Now, obviously, the more education you had, the more education you had. You see, if you're a medical student, you got the diagnosis correct on 42% of the EKGs. And if you're an attending cardiologist, well, then you got the diagnosis correct on 75% of the EKGs. But that was only slightly up from the 69% that was correct for practicing physicians. In the end, I think that this study kind of says a couple things. Well, first of all, it's a meta-analysis. I can't really break down the methods. They included different kinds of studies, but it is a meta-analysis, and what they found is what they found. But we all have room for improvement when it comes to reading EKGs. Period, end of story. It doesn't matter how high you are up in the totem pole of reading EKGs, from attending cardiologist all the way down to medical student, we can be better at reading EKGs. Number two, when you don't know what the EKG says as a practicing physician, well, have no fear, my friends, because the cardiologist only gets the answer correct an extra 6% of the time. So that it doesn't necessarily mean that you're not the brightest crayon in the box. You're still a really shining crayon. You're just missing it by 6%. 6% over the cardiologist. And number three, I think I'm not shocked by the results of this study. Lots of these studies had you look at 10 EKGs and say, what is this EKG? What is this EKG? And now, granted, they all had different inclusion criteria and different ways that they ran their study, but mostly it was looking at 10 to 15 to 20 EKGs and said, what is this EKG? What is this EKG? I think most people can get the easy EKGs correct. It is the really hard EKGs that look like a four-year-old drawing a scribbly doodle dally that are challenging to name, and they're challenging to diagnose, and they're challenging for everyone. I think a better question in this study, and although it was a meta-analysis, so they weren't really looking for that, but a better question in all these studies would have been to the providers or to the medical students or to the residents or to the cardiologists is, look at this EKG, what's the next best step in the management of this patient? Did the providers know to start CPR? Did they know, given a clinical vignette, to shock or push epi? Those are the things that I want to know. Not necessarily, did you get the exact right diagnosis? Did you know that there was early repolarization in certain leads? Did you know that there was ST abnormalities or abnormal ST abnormalities? Not necessarily STEMI or NSTEMI, STEMI, but just non-specific ST abnormalities. Did you pick that up? I don't necessarily care. But I do care that you knew what to do with the information when you looked at the EKG. So I guess with that, we'll move on to the next article, which seems to be fitting because in the last episode, I talked about physical therapy. Physical therapy at home does it just as good as if you're going into the outpatient setting. At least that's for individuals that had a total knee replacement. Well, this episode, I want to talk about a trial of physical therapy, except for acute back pain with sciatica. Yes, acute sciatica. There's not a lot of good options for this, but what about physical therapy? That is looked at in this paper titled Physical Therapy Referral from Primary Care for Acute Back Pain with Sciatica, a randomized controlled trial. In this single-blind parallel group randomized trial that took place in two Utah hospitals and randomized 220 patients to either receive early physical therapy or usual care, the primary outcome was score on the Oswestry Disability Index, OSW. I had to look it up, but it is a score that basically tells you how's your back pain affecting your overall daily living of disability. How's it helping your score? It ranges from 0 to 100, and higher scores indicate greater disability. Now, all patients were given a copy of The Back Book, which is a patient education booklet with evidence-based messages about the favorable prognosis of lower back pain. Because let's be honest, almost all lower back pain eventually gets better. But we want it better right now. And does physical therapy help? Well, in the early physical therapy group, they recommended 2 weekly sessions during the first 2 weeks and 1 to 2 sessions in weeks 3 and 4. And again, they also got the back book, which gave those evidence-based recommendations on how back pain can and usually will improve. So the results of the OSW score, the results on a 100-point scale. Well, if you just read the results from the paper, you would see our results found that early physical therapy referral after initial primary care visits for recent onset lower back pain and sciatica resulted in greater improvement in disability. There you have it, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. It says greater improvement in disability. So you would think, unless you actually went and read the paper, and then you will realize that this paper doesn't say what you think that this paper says. You see, participants in the early physical therapy group had greater improvement from baseline to 6 months for the primary outcome, which was this back pain disability score. But as the paper says, a minimum important difference is 6 to 8 points for acute lower back pain and sciatica. The actual results should have read something a little similar to this. Our results found that early physical therapy referral after initial primary care visit for recent onset lower back pain and sciatica resulted in greater statistical improvement in disability, but is arguable whether these statistical changes actually make a clinically important difference. Remember, they found a 5.4 difference if you got physical therapy, but earlier in their sentence or earlier in their paper, they said we need at least a 6 to 8 point change in lower back pain to be clinically significant. Well, if you didn't reach at least 6, I know 5.4 is close, but it is not 6. If you didn't reach 6, then you didn't reach a clinically important difference. The lesson is when you are using a scale to measure something in the study, also know or Google search and look into the minimally clinically important difference that is needed, because often you will have a statistical difference that may clinically not be important, and the authors will always try to spin their study so their results are important, whether they're actually clinically important or not. With that, let's move on to the next article, which is a fitting article for all of you parents out there. It is titled, Comparison of Acetaminophen or Paracetamol, if you live anywhere else in the world, with ibuprofen for treatment of fever or pain in children younger than 2 years, a systematic review and meta-analysis. In children younger than 2 years, what is better for short-term treatment of fever or pain? Do you choose ibuprofen or do you choose acetaminophen, I ask you? Well, the answer is it depends on where you live and which guidelines you follow. For example, the maximum daily dose of acetaminophen beyond the neonatal period varies from 60 milligrams per kilogram per day in New Zealand to 90 milligrams per kilogram per day in the United States and the United Kingdom. Are the children that much different in New Zealand and the United States? I don't think so. But the recommendations for ibuprofen also vary based on where you live. You see, New Zealand recommends ibuprofen at 5 milligrams per kilogram per dose 3 to 4 times daily starting at age 1 month with a max of 30 milligrams per kilogram per day. In the United States, the ibuprofen max daily dose is 40 milligrams per kilogram per day, and they start at 6 months of age. So, anytime ever that there is more than one answer, it means that likely neither are evidence-based and neither are correct. With this systematic review and meta-analysis, they looked at 19 studies that compared acetaminophen with ibuprofen for short-term treatment of fever or pain in children younger than 2 years. in total, out of all 19 studies, they were able to come to basically only 800 participants included in the final pain analysis. The main reason being is that a lot of these patients or a lot of these studies didn't include the participants that were trying to fit in the conclusion criteria. A lot of these studies didn't use pain as their, one of their final outcomes. There was just a lot of problems in trying to get this data. So although they looked at all these studies, it was, oh, here's a handful, 800 patients that we can look at. The primary outcomes were fever or pain within 4 hours of treatment onset, which is really all we care about. We want to give the medication, and within 4 hours, we want to see an improvement. Particularly if your kid is just screaming their head off, you want the results within 4 minutes, within 4 seconds, within 4 milliseconds. You want the results right now. Better, 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 faster, better. Ugh. And the headline results are the author's conclusions. You will see that the authors say, and I quote, "Moderate quality evidence from randomized studies showed that compared with acetaminophen, ibuprofen was associated with reduced temperature within 4 hours." However, if you go to figure 2 and look at the forest plot, you will see the difference between ibuprofen and acetaminophen has a confidence interval that always extends over the midline. For every single trial, the confidence interval extends over the midline. But the key is that the point estimate for the odds ratio was always on the side favoring Motrin or ibuprofen. Sure, we can say each individual trial individually was not or could not find this clinically significant difference between the two, but when combined all together and they combine the powers together, statistical significance occurs. You put your hands in, it reminds me of like a Power Rangers story or something. You combine the powers together in a statistical analysis and you will find statistical significance. There was not a trial that even had one, not one trial had a point estimate of the odds ratio in favor of acetaminophen. So we give ibuprofen to everyone, right? Not so fast. The authors did do a secondary analysis to see how young is too young. How young should we be giving a child ibuprofen? Is it safe to give a child ibuprofen if they're under the age of 6 months? And sadly, only two randomized trials that were looked at or studied had inclusion criteria that would include infants younger than 6 months, and this was just not enough information to draw any real conclusions. So I guess at this point, it is Tylenol till age 6 months, and then ibuprofen after that is probably okay. I think we can all agree that we do need some sort of large randomized controlled trial on this to just put this thing to bed. Sure, a nice meta-analysis is great and wonderful, but when you're only having a huge meta-analysis systematic review and you're coming up with only 800 patients, I mean, fever or pain in children is a dime a dozen. We could get this study done basically overnight. So I don't know why we're not doing it. If ibuprofen is really that much better, let's see where the difference is at. The authors do mention that ibuprofen has been used for closure of the patent ductus arteriosus in preterm infants, and no notable harms in the short term have been noted from any of the trials. So it's probably safe. But we need the trial. So if you are a hospital out there and you're listening to this, or you're just someone that looking to do a trial, you're a medical student, you're like, man, I want to put the trial, the biggest pediatric neonatal trial on infant trial on the map that's ever been done, this is your golden ticket right here. This is the trial that needs to be done. We think we all know, but this is the trial that needs to be done. And while we don't have enough evidence at this time to say, clearly, it is clearly seen that individuals that are less than 6 months can or cannot take ibuprofen, I would argue that, is there something magical that happens at 6 months? If the child or infant laying in front of you is 5 months, is there something magical that happens the next 30 days at 6 months that makes it so now they can magically take Motrin? I don't think so, but I don't know enough about infants and the development to make that statement. But from what I do know, I don't think so. And with that, let's move on to the next article. I'm going to hit on one more article and then wrap this one up like I have every one before it. So here we go. Weight loss in underserved patients, a cluster randomized trial. This is in the New England Journal of Medicine. In this study, which took 803 adults with obesity and enrolled them randomly to either intensive lifestyle intervention or usual care. Now, the intensive lifestyle intervention focused on reduced caloric intake and increased physical activity. They had health coaches that had programs with them, and it consisted of weekly sessions for the first 6 months, followed by monthly sessions for the remaining 18 months. Patients received personalized food intake and caloric intake targets, which were instructed to, and they were instructed to weigh themselves every day. They had digital connection scales. They had these health coaches calling them and setting up appointments with them to weigh themselves. What's your weight today? Okay, let's change your carbs. Let's change your protein. Let's change your this. Let's change your that. They had the full macho. The consultants, the coaches, the weight loss goals, they had it all. The primary care, or just the usual care, the primary normal group, just had this normal, here you go, lose some weight, here's a pamphlet, read this little booklet. The primary outcome was the percentage change from baseline in body weight at 24 months. The mean BMI at the start of the trial was 222 pounds, and that was for both groups. And maybe you're thinking, well, these people must be really tall, because they weighed 222 pounds and their BMI on average was 37. When you weigh 222 pounds, you are either obese or you're really tall. And these people were obese, or at least they met the morbidly obese definition or criteria. The percentage of weight loss at 24 months was significantly greater in the intensive lifestyle group. The change was about 5%. Than in the usual care group, which only had a much smaller change of about 0.5%. That means the difference between 5% and 0.5% is 4.5 percentage points. Yep, that's right. Now, 4.5 percentage points sounds really impressive. Look at how much better this intensive lifestyle group did than the usual care group. This means that over the course of 2 years, they lost 4.5% more. This is 4.5% of 220 pounds, which is basically around 10 pounds. This tells me one thing. These people were in a study that had weekly meetings with health coaches over the course of 2 years, and weekly nutrition goals, and weekly weighing themselves, and weekly scales, and weekly planning and targeting to meet weight loss goals. And they could only lose 10 pounds more than just the usual care group. Weight loss is really hard, really hard. Even when you're trying really hard and you have weight loss coaches and you have personalized food menus and meals and you have food personalized food intake plans and caloric consumption targets, all individualized just for you, weight loss is really hard. And although my mother used to tell me, Andrew, you are what you eat. My mother was not totally correct, because else by now I would have turned into a cookie. But it remains clear that Twinkies will turn you into a sponge cake. And with that, let's review these articles before this ship sets sail in the sea of evidence. If you're looking at EKGs and you don't know what to do, have no fear. There's probably only a 6% chance that maybe the cardiologist actually knows what that EKG says. So know the basics, know what you need to do, and know when to consult. Acute sciatica is really bad and we don't have a lot of good options for it. But what about physical therapy? Does that work? Well, if you just read the title of this paper and you just read the author's conclusions, then you would say, of course it works. Look at this. But if you actually read the paper, you will find that this paper does not say what you think that it says. It says that it did not meet clinical difference. Is it worth still sending them to a physical therapist? I would say probably not, but I've never had acute sciatica, and if you want to do something, it might be worth something to offer, because there was statistical difference there, but really, probably not. And certainly not if they're paying cash price out of pocket. For any medical student out there that wants to run the greatest trial of all time and have their name on the top head of a paper, well, we need to know which is better, acetaminophen or ibuprofen, for the management of fever in all comers. Who cares about six, less than six? Is there something different that happens at 5 months and 6 months? I don't think so. Give us a trial. Give us a large trial. Fever is a really common thing in kids. We should be able to get this trial done in 6 months' time. No questions asked. And last but not least, weight loss is hard. You aren't necessarily everything that you eat, but you are a version of what you eat. And even when you have a lot of health coaches and people rooting you on, calling you, making individualized plans for you, individualized exercise plans for you, weight loss is still really, really hard. And over the course of the 2 years, you're probably going to only lose an extra 10 pounds. And there's no saying that those 10 pounds are even going to stay off once all the coaches and everything disappears. So don't be discouraged and encourage your patient not to be discouraged. And with that, I'll end this episode as I've ended every episode before it. Wait for the music. And until next time, keep the quest and questioning.